ladies and gentlemen of the jury, the prosecution is not going to get that man today. No, because I'm going to get him.
And welcome to this edition of the Hagman and Hagman Report, coming to you live from our radio and television studios here in beautiful Northwest Pennsylvania, where we broadcast live weeknights, 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on the Global Star Radio Network, as well as Blog Talk Radio and YouTube Live. Those are our venues. Go to HagmanandHagman.com there to check out the venues, to watch our show live. And HagmanReport.com. That's our news information show prep site. That's where you got to go for show prep site. Please bookmark both of them. And subscribe. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, as well as follow us on our Facebook and Twitter channels. We've got just a fantastic, fantastic program for you planned. I'm just so excited. I want to thank Global Star Radio Network. Todd, thank you so much for all of your hard work. Thank you for everything that you do. Folks, Global Star is the shining light in the otherwise dark sea of whatever. So, but anyway, we have our first guest tonight is Mr. Scott Greer. He's the author of No Campus for White Men. It's a fantastic book. I got a hold of that book this week, and I just really went through it, and it's just, how topical is this information? Before we bring on our guest, I want to mention that portions of tonight's broadcast brought to you by Pro Flowers. Now, guys, with Valentine's Day fast approaching, let me just warn you, we got to take care of our ladies. And who among the ladies don't like to get flowers or that special gift from Pro Flowers, folks? Pro Flowers has done us a really great favor. If you go to HagmanReport.com and click on the banner at the top of our website at HagmanReport.com, Pro Flowers has given you a direct link to Pro Flowers and to the offers they are providing our listeners. Or go to ProFlowers.com and in the microphone box use our code Hagman. Just very simply go to proflowers.com and use our code Hagman. Help support our show by supporting our sponsors. Use our code Hagman at ProFlowers. Now's the time to do it. But we've got this hour a man I think you all know, or if you don't, perhaps I think you do. I think you've read his work, dailycaller.com, his latest book, which is just a fantastic book, No Campus for White Men. Joe, I'm going to have you bring him on, and then I want to say something too about it.
Yeah, he's a writer for the Daily Caller and an author, as my dad said. What the Daily Caller, for those of you who might not be familiar with it, it's a very interesting website. It digs up a lot of stories that that other people take and spread. It has great content on it. Scott, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
You sound powerful, great. Thanks. We had a little bit of a connection issue before, but boy, he's coming through loud and clear. Yeah, folks, Scott is the author of No Campus for White Men, but the subtitle is The Transformation of Higher Education into Hateful Doctrination. Now, we saw exactly what Mr. Greer is writing about. You know, there are some people out there who just are ahead of their time, and not only are they ahead of their time, they're exactly 100% accurate with their information. That's our guest tonight. As a matter of fact, in that book, No Campus for White Men, Milo, the subject of the riots at UC Berkeley this week, wrote the foreword to Mr. Greer's book. Mr. Greer, thanks for coming on, and let's hit the ground running. What in the world is going on? What happened at UC Berkeley this week? And talk to us.
Well, it's kind of the culmination of things that have been going on with Milo. I think ever since the election of Donald Trump, Milo has been getting a more violent response to when he speaks. He's always gotten a very strong protest when he speaks. I mean, he's very provocative. You know, he has no problem skewering political correctness. So he's always gotten people on campus upset when he comes to campus. But usually they just sit around, they hold signs. The only incident where he really had some, like, you know, disturbance and a little bit of violence was last year at DePaul University, where he showed up and protesters got on stage and began threatening him with fists, but no serious violence, nothing compared to what we saw last night or two nights ago happen there. But since Donald Trump has gotten elected, more of these kind of anarchists, these anti-fascists, that's what they like to call themselves, have been showing up at his events and starting to try to challenge police, throwing bottle rockets, throwing punches when they have the chance. I mean, on the night of inauguration at the University of Washington, there was several incidents of violence of people getting punched. There was even somebody who was shot during a scuffle when Milo showed up at the University of Washington. So this was stuff that was already happening, and this is just 2 weeks ago. So what happened in UC at Berkeley on Wednesday was just the culmination of that. He showed up on campus. Everybody knew what he was going to talk about. It's the same old thing. He was actually going to focus, reports show that he was going to focus on illegal immigrants. And basically what happened that it got so out of control is that there was no police manning the perimeter. They built a perimeter, but no police were there to enforce it. So thus, protesters were able to break through, start getting inside, breaking windows, setting fires, starting committing multiple assaults, just because somebody who has a conservative point of view, who's opposed to illegal immigration, who's opposed to mass immigration, who speaks out against radical Islam in a very provocative manner, was able to come on campus. And so this is all, it was bound for something to be happen like this, but the amount of violence is almost surprising, and that falls at the hands, or really at the feet of the administrators and the mayor of Berkeley, who did nothing to stop these anarchists from going out of control and attacking people.
Man, you're exactly right. And John Robertson, our program director and producer, and I were talking about this, and he knows Berkeley, UC Berkeley, like the back of his hand. That's his old stomping grounds. And we were speaking about this week and looking at this, doing kind of a post-mortem of what took place. And we watched, Joe and I watched Milo being interviewed by Tucker Carlson. But really, at the end of the day, and folks, Scott Greer wrote about this, wrote about what we're seeing here in the larger sense in his book. And again, his book is fantastic, No Campus for White Men, The Transformation of Higher Education. This, to me, is really so prescient for today's environment. But let's take UC Berkeley for a moment here.
Yeah, there's a couple areas that we need to look at. First of all, you mentioned the police.
Yeah.
Let's start here.
Let's do that.
We've seen the tweets that were put out by the mayor of Berkeley. I believe Janet Napolitano, former head of Department of Homeland Security, is involved in Berkeley in some way also. And there was also speculation of a stand-down order that was given to police. Have you heard anything more on that? Do you believe that to be the case?
I've heard sources say that. I haven't gotten a total confirmation on it, but I would not be surprised, and it's highly likely that they were told to kind of back away and just let them do what they want to do. Because, I mean, you got to consider who Janet Napolitano is, the president of the University of California system. This is a woman who's a known progressive who believes in all these, who doesn't like conservatives, who has been an advocate of granting amnesty to illegal immigrants, and somebody coming onto her campus and having a message that's very opposed to that. Not going to go over well with her. And the mayor of Berkeley had been calling Milo Yiannopoulos a white nationalist, you know, a bigot, in the days before, had been saying this hateful rhetoric will not be tolerated in Berkeley. And you know, he's clearly, Milo is not a white nationalist. He has said that multiple times. He's clearly not, I mean, he, you know, he's a gay man who prefers black men. I don't know how you can be a white nationalist and have that preference. But they still claim that for whatever reason. So these authority figures were pushing this narrative that we have these, like, neo-Nazi, this crazy neo-Nazi coming on campus, and that almost gave the message to the anarchists to start doing whatever. And it is very likely that the police, judging by the situation of these people are very anti-Trump, they're very pro-illegal immigration, that when somebody with that message that's contrary to that comes on campus And they just say, hey, let the protesters do it. They'll be peaceful. We're just going to let that happen. Then the police just stand down. I mean, it's very clear from evidence. If you just look at the visual evidence, you see cops on the roof of that building where all the riots are happening. Just with, they have the, you know, they have their gear. They have it all ready to take these people out. And they're just standing around. They're not really doing anything as they're watching the campus burn. And that's very, I don't, that's just very shocking image to see, just police being totally ineffective when what they're, you know, paid and trained to do, and that's their job, they're not allowed to do it. So it has to come from up top. It's not just the police officers deciding, we're just going to chill out inside in our riot gear while a riot happens. You know, the group that brought Milo paid the security fee to prevent the type of violence that happened. And clearly that security fee didn't work, and police just sat around and did nothing while rioters rioted. So it looks like a stand-down order of some kind was ordered.
And if I can just point something out here, we talk about lawfare quite often, and this is something Milo has spoken about. What happens is this, folks. If, for example, Milo, he's scheduled to speak at a university. And what happens a couple of days before that speaking time, a couple of days before the event, the
campus is where he's speaking and asks for a security fee.
Yeah, $3,000-$4,000, right, Scott? I mean, that's kind of how it goes.
It's actually $6,000 that they usually charge, even more for that.
So talk about that if you don't mind, because a lot of people don't really understand that. And that's one thing that I think people need to understand. There's kind of a portion of lawfare of censorship.
Yeah, that's what a lot of public universities have done. Private universities have a little bit more leeway to shut down Milo when he comes, because, you know, they aren't held to the same standards as public universities. Public universities are kind of required to have, or kind of forced to have people like Milo come to their campus and provide protection for him. But what a lot of universities have figured out is, like, well, we don't want Milo on campus, but we have a great idea. Right before the event, we're going to say to usually the College Republican chapter or the, you know, libertarian group that wants to have Milo, hey, you know, 5 days before, hey, you need to pay $6,000 or the event's off. You know, these are a bunch of college kids. You know, they're not going to have $6,000 on hand just to have a speaker. So this is a way to shut down. And this actually worked at a few places, but in particular at the University of Maryland in October. Milo was at a bunch of other campuses nearby, and one campus, I believe, is the University of Alabama. They had tried it, but they eventually forced the administration to back down over negative press. So this is like in September. But in October, a month later, University of Maryland, like 5 days before, they're like, told the students, you have to pay the $6,000 or the event's off. And they stood by that. They didn't, there wasn't as much press because, you know, busier news cycle, and they were able to get it hidden, and thus they were able to shut down the event. Now, with a lot of these, all these UC events, they've been charging these similar security fees, but students have been managing to pay for it. But that is still putting a burden on these students just to have the right to free speech. And as we saw at the Berkeley, you know, they didn't even protect the free speech. You know, they let people just get assaulted for wearing Trump hats. And so they didn't even grant what is given to these students by the Constitution and what is required of public universities to give them. And they just let it happen. But the $6,000 fee, they paid the $6,000 student fee or however much it was at Berkeley. At Maryland, it was $6,000. And they paid that, and they didn't even get their money's worth for it.
Yeah, and they don't get the money back either, it's my understanding.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah.
Unless they sue, of course.
Right, and who's going to do that? And, of course, that takes more time. But folks, members of the listening and viewing audience, please understand, when we talk about lawfare, when we talk about the fight of censorship against people like us, but even more specifically against people like Scott Greer, okay, with his book, or Milo with his presentations, this is very serious. They're trying to shut us down, shut us up, trying to shut up Scott Greer. In many cases, they'll say, well, you know, just the name of the book, for example, No Campus for White Men. Oh, how racist, and how we can't possibly have him. We can't possibly promote his book or have, you know, this is. And then that
sounds like the title of a DNC speech.
good one. Okay, all right. So who in the heck was at that Berkeley protest? Who was behind it?
And if I can only jump in, because you have both that answer on your website, on the Daily Caller's website. Here's who funded the group behind the call to arms at Milo's Berkeley event. And then there's another article, famous Berkeley professor. And then I saw, when I went home last night after the show, I turned on, I flipped through the news to see what's going on, and I saw that on CNN they were talking about the riots in Berkeley. And this is the exact segment that I saw, and I think I was drinking chocolate milk, and I almost spit it out when I saw this. It was the panel, there's three people, and I think Don Lemon was the host, and it was just the most ridiculous panel. I mean, I don't even know how these people are allowed to be on cable TV. But anyway, they go on to talk about and speculate about the fact that this could be a Trump administration people to Bannon, to Milo, paying right-wing people to dress up in the black and the masks and come in and start the violence and to make it look, like it's, you know, these crazy, you know, leftist rioters shutting down free speech. But no. It's actually, you know, Trump and Milo conspiring to give that appearance. What do you have to say to that, Scott?
That is one of the, in a year of ridiculous talking points, that's one of the most ridiculous talking points I've heard. The fact that these black bloc anarchists who describe themselves as anti-fascists are secretly Trump supporters is totally ridiculous. I mean, these people exist. You can interview them. They're frothing at the mouth at any idea that a conservative might have a scary point of view, and they're ready to attack them. The idea that these are secret Trump supporters is ridiculous, but it's getting passed around. It wasn't just Robert Icke, who's I believe still a Berkeley professor, and of course was in the Clinton administration as labor secretary. It was also passed on in the very popular progressive internet TV show The Young Turks. They were wondering, you know, these are actually, what if these are just right wingers who are hiding behind the mask? They're, you know, they're trying to cause a riot just so the University of California system can be defunded because they hate science, and UC system has science. So yeah, that's probably what it is. You know, these are just ridiculous conspiracy theories. You know, for years the left has accused the right of being, you know, knee-deep in conspiracy theories and promoting these ideas. What we're now seeing is, like, the worst form of Bircherism, or what would have called Bircherism back in the day, of just, like, you know, our government's taken over by Russians. It's actually, these rioters are actually secret Trump supporters. They all push these ideas in mainstream forms, and, you know, they believe it. I mean, they're just so driven by their anti-Trump hysteria that they'll just believe any ridiculous idea that comes to their head. And one of the funny things is, one of their favorite things that liberals love to say is a conspiracy theory is that, oh, George Soros is behind these protests, when conservatives say that. Well, actually, in this case, once a shocker of shocker, as the Daily Caller has reported, Daily Caller Chuck Ross, George Soros does have a connection to the group. The group that Refuse Fascism, which started this, which organized the protest, has direct fundraising from groups associated with George Soros. So once again, liberals think is a conspiracy theory turns out to be true.
Yeah,
while they're engaging in conspiracy theories.
Yep.
You're referencing the, I read the article, and you're referencing the Tide Foundation, which is a well-known Soros group. One of the donors that's also listed in the article kind of took me by surprise was the city of Tucson was a donor to this group. And that made me, I mean, is this taxpayer money, or is this a person inside the city of Tucson? But on the website, it says that it is the city of Tucson is a notable donor along with the United Steelworkers Labor Union. And to see a city on that list, to back these, and what they're backing is the Alliance for Global Justice and Refuse Fascism. And the Alliance for Global Justice raised $2.2 million, ending in March 2016. And that's just alarming to me.
Yeah, and this is very typical. These groups get funded by, I mean, it's almost funny, all these anti-capitalist groups are funded by the biggest corporations. They end up, because what happens is these corporations are forced in, and large entities are forced into giving money into these things that they were promoting social justice. What happens, that money funnels to more radical groups, and eventually it ends up to people such as Refuse Fascism, who are basic organizing protests that descend into riots. And we always see this happen with, and it's shocker, somehow George Soros always has a role in this. So a lot of these things that that people, that the left likes to see as a conspiracy theory from the right turns out to be true, well, they're promoting ridiculous conspiracy theories that these people who are rioting are secret Trump supporters. So it's kind of funny that that these things turn out this way.
Absolutely. I saw an interesting quote today that reminded me of exactly what we're seeing. And the quote from Winston Churchill was, "The fascists of the future will be called anti-fascists." And, I mean, isn't that what we're seeing today? These groups, anti-fascism, refuse fascism, the using these...
Antifa.
Yeah, that's the anti-fascism.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Using these fascist and just oppressive tactics in the name of tolerance and free speech, and it's so backwards. Can you speak to the tolerance, what's called the intolerance that's called tolerance on the left?
Yeah, there is a the left one, and I describe this in my book, No Campus for White Men, is that when the left speaks about tolerance, they're thinking it's only tolerance for ideas that they think are not going to be hurtful to their people. The, you know, the great, or not really great, but infamous Marxist philosopher Herbert Marcuse kind of argued for this with his form of tolerance, that they shouldn't, allow ideas that they think is going to lead to fascism, that is going to lead to so-called oppression, that there should be zero tolerance for these kind of ideas. And this, is kind of listed in how they, how they approach free speech. They don't actually believe in free speech if it goes against their interests. They believe in a type of tolerance that only supports people they view as the oppressed. While if say you can if they think they can label something as leading to fascism, they can suppress it because that's not actually, that is tolerant in their view because they're helping out the oppressed minorities. And we're seeing this play out in many ways with the microaggression craze that is now gripping college campuses and even going into some of the workplace, is that these kind of unconscious slights against minorities by the majority culture that comes out, and like, you know, if you say a joke, an off-color joke, that's not just an off-color joke, that's akin to something like a lynching. That's in their mindset when they see the microaggression. And colleges try to use this idea to suppress free speech because it's not just ideas they disagree with, it's something that's threatening the physical safety of themselves. They claim that because that gives them a greater argument to suppress viewpoints they don't like.
Interesting. Wow. If I may, a Mexican, a black, a Muslim imam, and a priest walk into a bar. No, I guess I'm not allowed to finish that.
I don't know. You're really threatening my safety right now. I don't know if I can walk home tonight. My heart's paid just at the words of that. I don't know if I can handle that.
What's the mindset behind that? That somebody's words or their own ideology, their own beliefs and viewpoints can physically threaten or hurt another person. I saw a clip that had to do with the Berkeley riots. I think it was in a Paul Joseph Watson video. He shows one of the organizers of the protest, and it's a lady who talks about when Milo comes there and with what he says, that he's raping and trying to rape and kill her with his speech. Is that what you're talking about? The somebody's beliefs and their free speech and these people's perception on the other side, that it is actually physically hurting their mind, their body in some way?
It's twisted.
Yeah, that's what they're saying. And that happens every... once a week on college campus. I think one of my favorite examples of this is that I'm blanking out on the university, but there was a university that had a student that was about to show the movie, the gay rights movie, Stonewall, which is about the Stonewall riots. And, you know, this is like, oh, we're promoting social justice, we're promoting progress. Well, no, actually, the transgender students thought this was an outrage, and their arguments is like, this, showing this movie threatens my safety. You know, this is showing a gay rights movie. The school showing a movie that's pro-gay rights somewhere on campus threatens the physical safety of transgender students. Somehow, I don't know how you make that argument, but, you know, they believe it. So they were able to shut down that showing of the movie, which is just ridiculous. It's preposterous that this is like a legitimate argument, but these arguments happen all the time on college campus. Now, sometimes they say, and I've seen this argument used against Breitbart News. There's a lot of people who are trying to boycott Breitbart News, which Breitbart News is the employer of Milo Yiannopoulos. They're trying to use this argument that the reason why they want companies to not advertise with it is not because of Breitbart's politics. It's because Breitbart's news stories lead to hate crimes that actually cause violence towards people. Now, there's no evidence that a Breitbart news story has caused a hate crime anywhere. But they claim this anyway, and they just act like, well, we don't have to prove facts. And I've seen this, a lot of people repeat this, that Milo's words and Breitbart's, you know, news stories are somehow going to lead to violent hate crimes, and there's evidence of it. Now, if you ask them for a hate crime, they're not going to give it to you, of course, because there are no hate crimes caused by Breitbart or Milo. They just use this tactic because it makes sense to them, and it feels right. It doesn't have to be right. They care about an idea feeling right more than an actually being right in reality. But it's a powerful argument for them to say, instead of I disagree with this idea, here's the facts and reason why. It's much better for them to say, these ideas are going to kill me, and if the school allows this to happen, my safety is in jeopardy. That is a much more effective argument for these students to use to suppress speech and to get their way.
Excellent. Scott, we are up against the break. Folks, you're listening to Scott Greer from The Daily Caller on this edition of the Hagman & Hagman Report. He's going to be with us into the next segment at the end of the hour, until the end of the hour. And we got so much to talk about. If you go on HagmanReport.com, and if you go to the article for the show today, what you will find, Leftists Love Islamic Lies. In that show description, you can get the link to Scott Greer's Facebook page, the Facebook page for his book, as well as a link to the Daily Caller. I would urge everybody to bookmark the Daily Caller and check it on a regular basis. It's a very informative and great website that we link articles to pretty often on our site. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Visit HagmanReport.com for the news and articles that matter most. Stay tuned. We will be right back. In a thrilling series of novels, T.C. Joseph takes us into the lives of three families who struggle to maintain normal lives in a world where conspiracy theory and Bible prophecy collide. T.C. Joseph's viewpoint of alternative history and understanding of prophetic events will change your view of the world and the events on our horizon. Kirkus Review states, readers of end times fiction will be hard-pressed to find it done more intriguingly than this. Extremely readable and fast-paced, Blue Wink Reviews boldly states, fans of Tim LaHaye's Left Behind series and Tom Parada's The Leftovers will find this thought-provoking series absolutely riveting. Order your copies of T.C. Joseph's This Generation series from Amazon.com. Book 1, Precipice. Book 2, Pentecost. And Book 3, Penance.
In these uncertain times, it makes sense to have a sustainable backup method to cook food and boil water. If your current plan includes using a fuel-burning stove or cooking over an open fire, then there's a much better way. The Minuteman Rocket Stove is a biomass-burning cooking stove that only requires small quantities of sticks and twigs for fuel. The Minuteman Stove is easy to use, smokeless, portable, powerful, and sustainable. For the finest in survival cooking stoves and fire starters made right here in the USA, go to MinutemanStove.com. That's MinutemanStove.com.
You may never look at your city, town, or its people the same way ever again. Stained by Blood, a murder investigation based upon a true story by private investigator Douglas J. Hagman. Using the character Mark Stiles, Hagman takes you on a journey behind the scenes where the homicide becomes a secondary to an underworld of satanic ritual abuse, child abduction, and even mind-controlled experimentation. A world dismissed as conspiracy by those who want to keep its secrets hidden. exposing the dangers, denials, and deceptions. For 5 years, a brutal killer remained on the loose, free to kill again. As Mark struggles to navigate the maze of bizarre twists and untangle a web of deeply hidden secrets kept by some of the most powerful and influential people in this community and beyond. Stained by Blood. Order your copy of this engaging novel today at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood.
To this edition of the Hagman and Hagman Report, a very special guest, Mr. Scott Greer. He's the author of No Campus for White Men. I would urge everyone right now or after the show, go to Amazon.com or WND Books or wherever Scott Greer tells you the best place to buy this and order his book, No Campus for White Men. Right now it's number one in its category on Amazon. All right, it's a good read. There's no wasted words or wasted space in this book. 240 pages. Number one in politics, social sciences, cultural policy, and overall, it's in the top. It's really in the top 1% of all books, or top 1/10 of 1% of all books on Amazon. And it's one of those books where I wish I would have written that. Seriously, it's got a lot of great information in it. And he's our guest tonight, Daily Caller as well. DailyCaller.com, associate editor. For that website. Before we get back to our guest, guys, listen to me. If I can do this, you can do this. I have already taken care of my wife, flowers for my wife for Valentine's Day. I did it. You can do it too. Here's the deal. Here's how you do it. Go to proflowers.com. You select the date that you want the flowers delivered. In my case, it was a certain specific day around Valentine's Day because that day is special for us for other reasons. And in under 2 minutes, you make your selection, you're in and out under 2 minutes. It's the easiest way to do things. It's foolproof. And if you're tired, and you should be tired of guessing what you want for Valentine's Day and getting it wrong, well, now this is a fail-proof way to look like a pro. This year, ProFlowers is making it easier than ever before by taking all the guesswork out. On top, folks, on top of their already low prices right now, you can get, now listen to this, 2 dozen assorted roses with a free glass vase for $29.99 plus shipping and handling. You cannot go to your local florist or any florist and get it for Valentine's Day, get this deal. Not even close. And here's a better deal. Upgrade for just $9.99 more, $9.99 more. You can get 2 dozen long stem assorted roses with a premium vase and chocolates. Oh, she will love you to death. I have already taken care of my wife for that special day. Why don't you do it as well? Select the delivery day you want. Order now and have it delivered on Valentine's Day or the day you specify, right to her home or to her work. You're going to look like the pro. So here's the only way to get 2 dozen assorted roses free. I'm sorry, 2 dozen assorted roses with a free glass vase starting at $29.99. Just go to proflowers.com. Use our code word Hagman. Help support our show by supporting our sponsors. Again, use our code Hagman. That's proflowers.com. Click on the microphone and type in our code Hagman. Don't wait. Order today. This deal expires soon. Joe, Scott Greer is somebody that I really respect and admire his writings. Listen to this. On top of, this is from No Campus for White Men. On top of the thousands of students expressing their dismay at the election, professors and administrators offered to coddle them by canceling classes, rescheduling tests, providing free counseling to the aggrieved. A few schools have vowed or turned themselves into sanctuary campuses. Maybe that plural probably should be campi, and resist any attempts by the federal government to enforce immigration laws. Anarchy at its best.
Yeah, one of the during this campaign before the election, one of the things that really caught my eye was the Trump 2016 chalkings that rattled universities nationwide. somebody or people wrote Trump 2016 on sidewalks with chalk.
Yeah.
And students were, I guess if we take their word for
triggered.
It, physically ill, triggered,
yeah.
had to get safe spaces, counseling. This new phenomenon has been taken to a whole new level. And if we can, let's get into this Generation Snowflake, politically correct climate. Is this being allowed to continue because the media and the people in charge of many of these institutions are enabling it? Or is there something else behind this?
Well, they are, administrators are enabling it, but there is something deeper behind it. I think the fact that we have this growing, the two things that are most driving campus insanity, I would say, are identity politics and victimhood culture. Identity politics, roughly speaking, is where you approach politics not through, you know, say a set ideology. Well, it comes with an ideology, but it's not, say, facts and reason. All of your political ideas are based on around your idea that you ascribe. Identity you ascribe to yourself. So if you're a black man, that is your all your politics. That's all you need to know. That's your politic. That's your politics. That's where you base your politics on. If you're a gay man, that's all your politics right there. And that's very much the basis on identity politics, is that you argue for your position based on the identity you take for yourself. And when it happens on college campuses, many of these kids, they got into college based on the fact that they said, I'm a part of a minority group. When they are applying to colleges on the admissions process, they said, I'm African American, I'm a Native American, I'm this. And they were allowed to go into school due to affirmative action. That affirmative action forces schools to have preferences for racial minorities over whites and increasingly over Asian Americans as well. So many of these students, they got into school based on their identity, and then they say, hey, why not continue it for the next 4 years? And that's very much what we're seeing now, is that students are forming ideas based on a racial identity or a sexual identity, whatever they choose, and that is becoming the core focus of their being. And that's why that's very much what they're arguing for on campus, is that a lot of these things that they're pushing for, it's only for a specific group. I think when we saw a lot of these protests that were happening in the wake of the University of Missouri in November 2015, where students said, we have systemic racism going on. There is, like, all this evil white supremacy on this campus, and we need this. When you looked at their demands, it was all based on helping exclusively African Americans over their fellow students and giving them special status. You know, they were going to get special counseling that wasn't available to all their students. They were wanting special housing. They were wanting all these things that would only be available to African Americans. And even at a few schools, I believe it's California State University at Los Angeles, they've even built segregated dorms for African American students that are cheaper and more and arguably better than other dorms that are available to all students regardless of their race. And African American students are able to have this exclusive privilege that recalls Jim Crow, of course, because segregated dorms, segregated housing, very similar. I mean, I wonder if they want segregated water fountains next, but they're better than the white student fountains. And this is the type of things that they're demanding, is that it's only solely reserved for students themselves. And the next part is the victimhood culture, which is building a moral culture that is not based on, say, honor or dignity ascribed or, say, the rights that you are given by God. It's based on the fact that who is the more victimized person, who has the most oppression, that gives them greater status in that society that adopts a victimhood culture. So say that a person is trying to win an argument. They appeal to, well, I'm a victim, I'm a minority, I'm oppressed, thus I have greater status than you, person who are privileged, who have power, supposedly, and thus I win an argument, I gain higher status. So a lot of what we're seeing on college campuses is that students are competing to who can be the bigger victim, and thus they get more privileges that way, because in that moral culture that they're developing, moral status is ascribed to who is more oppressed. And it's usually not based on your socioeconomic standard. You know, you can be a poor white kid from coal country where your parents are, you know, have no money at all and you somehow manage to get to college, but you're privileged, and versus somebody who is a child of millionaires who happens to be African American, that person's a victim just because of their racial identity.
Yeah, and I saw an interview the other day, I think it was last night, where they talked about, you know, how white privilege is collective guilt. And what you're saying, though, is that depending on the identity or the label the person chooses, and you know, how that group is perceived, they get special status, special rights. We saw this with the when the homosexual marriage stuff came out from the Supreme Court. It says with the LGBT community, with the bathroom issues, and we saw the Obama administration pander to this a lot by elevating their status, as you said, and giving them special rights, special privileges, which is completely anti-constitutional. Everybody's created equal and should be treated equally under the law, but we don't have that in our culture today. Do you think under the Trump administration we're going to get back to that? Everyone should be created equal, considered equal, or will the special privileges, special rights be given during this administration?
Well, I think the administration is looking towards that. I mean, because Jeff Sessions is in all likelihood going to be the next Attorney General, and he is a big believer in the rule of law, that we're all equal before the rule of law, and he would definitely restore that in what he oversees in the Department of Justice. And that's the most important thing in our society, is that the fact that when somebody's in court, that they are treated equally no matter what their background is. And I think that's a very important part of our society, and that's one of the things, many things, that makes America great. When it comes to college campuses, I mean, the Trump administration is dealing with a different problem, because this is so deeply embedded in campuses. I cite numerous examples in No Campus for White Men of how this is so deeply embedded into higher education at this point, that it's so tough for Trump to do it. It's almost, they have to threaten administrators to put pressure to counteract this nefarious ideology working its way into higher education. Because all these students that are getting in, it almost has to be very radical what could happen. I mean, the fact of the matter is that affirmative action looks like it's going to stay in the next 4 years, I mean, barring something radical happening. And that's what immediately causes students to gravitate towards these identity and to start to think in ways of, like, if I'm a victim, I get these greater benefits. Because, the reason why we have affirmative action is apparently because originally it was intended to alleviate discrimination that was real and existing, that happened under Jim Crow and other, and other things in the past. But what happens now with affirmative action is that the fact that if you can claim I'm a victim and I'm this way because of my racial or sexual identity, I get greater privileges. And that's a very tempting offer for a young person to have, because it gives them a leg up over all their students. I think the Trump administration is going to try it. I think when Trump, in the wake of the UC Berkeley riots, he tweeted out, if UC Berkeley is not going to respect, free speech, they're going to get defunded. I think the Trump administration, if they keep seeing these riots, if they keep seeing this insanity, they're going to use whatever power they can to try to push back against it.
Yeah. The Trump issuing warnings about pulling federal funding, and I think that's part of the reason we saw the speculation of, oh, these were, outside agitators and they were right wingers, because they're trying to, one thing with the media especially that is just incredible during this last year is all this anti-Trump violence. They have, whether it's been successful or not, they've turned around and tried to blame Trump or the Trump supporters for it, even though it's been proven to be the completely opposite. Now, would it be effective just pulling the funding? I mean, what other remedies or options do we have, and does the president have?
I think it would be effective. I mean, you look at sanctuary cities. He's saying, I'm going to pull funding if you're not going to follow immigration law. And now there's a few cities, such as Miami, that are saying, oh, well, we're changing our policy. We're not going to comply with immigration law, because these schools depend on federal funding. I mean, Barack Obama was able to shut down ITT Tech, which is for a for-profit school, because he saw it as not a real education center. He pulled federal funding through student loans, and ITT Tech could not survive without it, and they shut down. So if he does have a legitimate threat that they're going to have their federal funds pulled for what they're doing on campus, I think they're going to have to change. That's all. You have to use the power of the bully pulpit against bullies.
Well, you got that right. I've got a question for you. As I was reading your book and I finished it, again, folks, this is just an incredible book. No Campus for White Men, author Scott Greer. Get it on Amazon or well, when should, would Amazon be the best place or WND?
Amazon
or?
And the WD Superstore. It's not out yet in bookstores. It'll be out next month and okay. At Barnes & Noble and all the other great bookstores.
Okay, so Amazon and WND Books, their bookstore. All right, very good. One thing I wanted to ask you this after I got done reading this. This book, well, the publication date was in March, right? March of this, we're about 8 months ago, seven, 8 months ago, right?
Yeah, it's the publication date is next March. Well, it's technically March 14th, but
oh, wait a second. I'm sorry. I'm well, duh. Okay, this is 2017. All right, never mind. Let me rephrase the question then. Yeah, here's a guy. Here I am. I don't even know what year it is. Is there anything when you were writing this book that surprised you? Any of your investigative findings that surprised you at all? That you thought, wow, this is even worse than I thought.
I think one of the things that surprised me, I've been covering education issues for almost 4 years now, is that not necessarily when I was writing it, because I was starting to get surprised. What drove me to write it was my surprise over what happened in November 2015 at Yale University and the University of Missouri. In the same week, I briefly alluded to the University of Missouri earlier, but at University of Missouri, they were able to force out their president over basically them finding what was a swastika made out of feces in a school bathroom, and other claims that there was racism going on because somebody heard a racial slur, overheard a racial slur, and there's this horrific campus climate being developed here at the University of Missouri. And they were able to force them out by convincing over 30 African-American players to go on strike against the school until the president resigned and he got axed. And at the same time, at Yale University, there was all this argument going on over cultural appropriating, Halloween costumes that engage in cultural appropriation, which is like, if you dress up as an Indian, well, that's not going to be tolerated. And it keeps descending further and further down the list. You know, I think even pirates might be able to complain now under cultural appropriation of Halloween costumes, but I mean, just with the ridiculousness that's going on. So basically, there was this whole debate at Yale, and two professors, or one professor and her husband, wrote an op-ed that's saying that, look, you know, this is college. You're supposed to, you know, be a little bit edgy. You're supposed to engage in, you know, a little bit of cultural appropriation. Don't be, you know, so, you know, prudish about this. You know, just let free speech happen. And that was basically like saying that, oh, we're Nazis. Just accept it to the rest of the campus. That's how they appropriated it. And they did a whole mob around the husband of the woman who wrote this, and they yelled at him, they screamed at him, they called him a bigot or a racist, even though he's a standard liberal. They were just hateful over the idea of cultural appropriating Halloween costumes, which is just such a ridiculous and petty issue. And at some point, of course, a hoax happened in this that African-American woman claimed that she was not allowed into a fraternity party because she was black. It turned out that they were at capacity, and there was numerous minorities there, so it was a once again, a case of fake news. You know, fake news has existed for a little bit, for a while now, with hate crime hoaxes. So these two events, what I was seeing is like, this is just ridiculous because I was seeing all these protests. It's like, you know, I really want to investigate what's happening here. And I think what over time has just surprised me is that when I was covering this stuff, you know, there wasn't that much student engagement. There weren't these crazy protests. You know, I only graduated college, you know, 4 years ago, and I don't remember ever being told to check my white privilege or, you know, you can't read this book. There's a trigger warning over it. I never saw this stuff, and I think that's what drove me to write this book, is just the shock I was seeing over 4 years of covering these issues and not being too far removed from college, being like, hey, what is going on here? I want to know what's the difference.
Yeah, it's definitely crazy, to say the least. And I'm confused about, you know, this identity stuff that, you know, you mentioned the Halloween costumes. I thought under this, you know, mindset that these people have, if I wanted to be a black woman, for instance, if I felt like I was a black woman, am I not entitled to be a black woman? Isn't that what, you know, these the gender identity and sexual orientation. Isn't that what that's about?
Yeah, in some ways, but I think one thing I point out in No Campus for White Men is that when whites try to adopt an identity, even if it's an African-American identity, I think we saw that with the Rachel Dolezal case in the summer 2015, which is coming right off of Caitlyn Jenner, you know, of somebody claiming that a man claiming is a woman. We celebrate it when it's a white woman claiming she's an African-American. It's an outrage, but hey, what's the difference here? You know, why are you going to celebrate one thing and not the other? But I think it comes down to when white people and a lot of what this moral culture that's being developed, this victimhood moral culture, are put at the bottom. They can't take an identity either, of course not in whiteness. That is not going to be tolerated at all. While they're going to celebrate black, Hispanic, Asian identity, and they're not going to, zero tolerance for white identity. But at the same time...
No, go ahead. Finish the thought.
Yeah, and when they have... And when it comes down to race, they're not going to tolerate that. If whites say, well, I'm a Hispanic, you know, they're not going to like that. I think that's almost in some ways that Elizabeth Warren is very, you know, Pocahontas, as Donald Trump called her, is very hesitant to really push that her Native American heritage, because if the fact that it was discovered that she actually, you know, it is totally bogus and she just used that to further her career, the left that sees her as a hero would turn against her because they do not like this idea of whites stealing their identity.
Exactly.
And what about if I wanted to be Irish? Would that be okay? A white identity? I'll leave it alone.
Yeah, the absurdity of being absurd. Scott, let me get your take on what we saw right after the inauguration, the females marching all across, not just America, but all across the world. What is, in the context of your book, No Campus for White Men, what do you see with respect to the female march, the female, I am woman, hear me roar, and some of the castrated, wussified men out there who have to give their wives their testicles to hold in their purses while they march with them. What do you see? What's your take on this?
Well, I do have a chapter on this in No Campus for White Men, which is all fixated on rape culture. I call it rape culture feminism. There is this huge thing that's on campus that there is a, you know, vicious rape culture, not only in colleges, but in America in general. It's just heightened at college campuses. And women believe that 1 in 5 women are sexually assaulted during their time in college, that men use their power for malicious ends, and just women are just on a daily basis it's oppressed, but it's usually over the slightest things. I mean, if you see this, a lot of the feminism that was animating the Women's March was over the, you know, the most nonsensical things. I mean, these are the same women who complain about manspreading. Manspreading, of course, I got to warn your listeners and your viewers about manspreading. It is one of the most troubling things you're going to hear. It's when men spread their legs too far in public transportation and where somebody else can't sit down or can't sit down comfortably. I know this is very disturbing to a lot of the people when they hear about manspreading, but it's out there and they're worried about it. There's also mansplaining, when apparently a man explains something to a female in a way that they view as condescending. So these are the kind of very petty things that are not really issues that they fixate on, and this is heightened at college campuses. And it was just kind of exposed for the general public during the Women's March, because I walked around during the Women's March in Washington, D.C., and I saw all these signs. It was like, you know, get your tiny hands out of my uterus, you know, get your tiny hands off this. I mean, everything had referenced tiny hands. I guess they all thought it was an original, line against Trump, is that, you know, there's this war on them, on women in general, by society, by this evil masculine society, and that men in some ways need to be changed in order for there to be a more equal society, in their opinion.
You know, when you were explaining the manspreading part, my father was like, what is he talking about?
I've never heard of that.
Wasn't there a man arrested on a New York City subway not too long ago?
I think, yes, there was a man. I don't know if he was right, but he at least got a citation for man-spreading. Yeah, it is, you know, most normal people are not aware that this is a problem because, you know, it's not a problem. But if you read, you know, left-wing websites like Slate or Salon or Jezebel, you think this is one of the worst things happening in our society today. So, I mean, but look out. Hopefully your listeners are now on the lookout for it.
Well, we're going to have, you know, Scott, we're going to have you come back on, like, on a weekly basis to update us on the latest
social
misdemeanor
trends.
Misdemeanors that we could possibly mansplaining.
It's Article 3.
Explain that, Lucy. You know, seriously, this is ridiculous. We got about 2 minutes left, and this time has gone just by so quickly. Again, our guest, Scott Greer, his book, No Campus for White Men. I would suggest everyone to get a copy of that as soon as possible. Scott, give us your closing comments here in the next 2 minutes. The floor is yours.
Well, I am the author, of course, of No Campus for White Men. I hope your listeners and viewers can follow me on Twitter at Scott M. Greer. And hopefully, I think right now what we're seeing with at UC Berkeley is just the beginning. As famous Hollywood director Judd Apatow threatened Trump supporters on Twitter in the wake of it, as he was showing support for the riots, and other celebrities are showing support for riots, we're going to start seeing more violence, more aggression, not only on campus, but in other places in general, due to the kind of dangerous ideas that are floating among the left and is their anti-Trump hysteria. And unfortunately, this has become the case. But as I said before, you know, this is kind of where we're heading. We're kind of heading to a dark path, but hopefully the Trump administration can turn us around.
And I hope you're right. And I want to thank you again, Scott, for joining us. We definitely have to have you on in the future, folks. Scott Greer from The Daily Caller, fantastic website. If you don't have it as one of your regulars, you check on a daily basis, bookmark it, and make sure you check it because they are on the tip of the spear when it comes to breaking down the political chaos that is going on in our country. And also, don't forget, No Campus for White Men, The Transformation of Higher Education into Hateful Indoctrination, available on Amazon. That is the book authored by Scott Greer. We look forward to having you on in the future, Scott. Keep up the good work.
Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Randall Terry. His website is voiceofresistance.org. Don't go anywhere. It's going to be a very fascinating 2 hours right after these short messages. Stay with us.
Greenovative. Go to HagmanReport.com. Click on the link to Greenovative. What Greenovative is, it's a small company in Florida. They created something called the GMAG Power Cell. It produces electricity by adding salt water to this unit that recharges rechargeable batteries. It's the coolest thing you'll ever see in your life. It's really neat. Really a super device. All right, you need just 2 teaspoons of ordinary table salt, a little water, but a bing, you're charging your rechargeable batteries. Super GMAG Chargeable is affordable, it's lightweight, weighs about 8 ounces, it's durable, it's EMP proof, and it's environmentally friendly, that it is. It'll provide safe and convenient power for recharging 6 AA batteries off the grid when other power sources aren't available anywhere, anytime, in any weather, day or night. Go to greeninnovative.com. That's greeninnovative.com. Perhaps you're a business out there, a small business. Would you like to extend the reach of your business? I bet you would. Would you like to have the same opportunities as companies such as Omaha Steaks, Pro Flowers, and Casper Mattress, and some of the bigger companies out there? Would you like to have that same power? Advertise on our program. Go to HagmanandHagman.com or send an email to opportunities@HagmanandHagman.com. If you go to HagmanReport.com and HagmanandHagman.com, there's a link where you can, it's a big red box. You'll see it. Click on that link and go ahead and read the benefits that we have created for you. I think it's a fabulous opportunity.
investors, timberland has become the symbol of safety. Global tropical timber demand continues to surge as the world's population increases. The need for managed, sustainable timber production forests has never been greater. When stock markets crash, trees keep growing. Direct ownership of fully managed tropical timberland acreage is now available to accredited investors. Prime, valuable hardwood groves close to the beautiful Costa Rican border generate and maintain superior long-term wealth. Consider visiting our forest plantations. Qualified accredited investors should go to PreciousTimberProfits.com or dial 855-888-6288 for more information. Call 855-888-6288 or visit PreciousTimberProfits.com. This announcement does not constitute either an offer to sell securities or a solicitation of an offer to purchase. Offering made by prospectus only. 855-888-6288, PreciousTimberProfits.com. PreciousTimberProfits.com.